You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Okay. Thank you for coming back for this session. And as long as I step on here, I realized I have a very strong challenge. Especially, this is a session immediately after lunch, and we already had a very intensive discussion for the whole morning, and then after, followed by a very dynamic discussion on the geopolitics around the territory issues. So we need to find some way to revive up our spirits and also get the the atmosphere going on again. And by the way, my name is Wang Tao, the resident scholar and the Tsinghua Carnegie Center for Global Policy, which is a joint research venture between the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Tsinghua University. It was established in April 2010, and we have now 8 scholars based in Beijing doing research on various areas, and I'm the researcher on the climate and energy policies. So to many of you, whenever you have a next chance to be in Beijing, I would encourage you to say hi and knock on my door, and I would be very welcome to have a chat with you. With that, I think I have very honored to introduce our great panelists, and including 2 speakers that I, speaking off record, that I think probably the most influential speakers in our panel today, because both of them are Nobel Prize laureates. The first one is Cathy DeLotta, Director of East Asian Affairs of U.S. Department of Energy. And Cathy is currently oversees the collaborations with Japan, China, and Korea, and Mongolia. And before, she also held positions as senior policy advisor and the Department of Treasury, as also the UN climate negotiation and the US-China 10-year framework for energy and environment collaborations under Secretary of Paulson. So she is very experienced, and welcome, Cathy. The second is Director Zhou Dadi, Emeritus Director General of the Energy Research Institute of the National Development and Reform Commissions. And I remember this morning when Kevin introduced Dr. Yang Fuqiang, he said he is the person after Dr. Yang said, everyone seems to be agree with him. And I think, and I believe Dr. Zhou would be the exception. And he is, if not more, but at least as influential in the Chinese policy, energy policies in as Dr. Yang. And we look very much to hear his insightful observations. And Dr. Zhou is now a counselor of the State Council, vice chairman of the State Expert Advisory Committee to the National Energy Leading Groups to China, and a vice chairman of China Energy Research Society. And before that, he served as director general for the Energy Research Institute of NDRC for 8 years, and also the chief scientist for the expert team of China and the lead author of the IPCC report. And for that contribution, he was also awarded the 2007 Climate Protection Award of the U.S. EPA, which is exceptional for a Chinese scientist. And with these 2 very strong speakers, we also have 2 very experienced commentators for their talk. The first is Michael Reid. He's the Director of Emerging Technologies of Duke Energy. And Michael has 20 years of progressive professional experience in regulated electric utilities, automobile, and consultancies. And before that, Reid also works with the Progress Energy as the Director of Environmental Services. The last but not least is Dr. Zhou Nan, which is now the Deputy Director of China Energy Group of Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, and also the Director of U.S.-China Clean Energy Center, which focuses on the building of energy efficiency established between the agreement established by President Obama and Hu Jintao 2 years ago. And she used to be the assistant professor in 2 Japanese universities, so I assume you also speak in Japanese as well. With that, I think we have very good teams for this discussion, and without further ado, let's please join me to welcome our first speaker, Cathy.
Good afternoon. Again, my name is Dr. Cathy DeLotel, and I'm the Director of East Asian Affairs at Department of Energy. My office basically coordinates across DOE. We have a lot of different types of programs, including nonproliferation, coal, renewable energy. And we have a very long-standing history with China. So there's a lot of things that I could be talking about, but I'm going to very briefly give you a history of some of our work on coal. And then I wanted to talk more broadly about some of the opportunities of working with China, specifically in coal, as well as some of the barriers and how DOE is working on mitigating some of those barriers. So first, just a brief overview of DOE's fossil energy program with China. It began under the S&T agreement in the mid-80s. We started working on R&D on coal-powered plants with the Chinese very early on. This was right before China became a net importer of fossil energy, and it was very important to help them, at the time, help them actually look at their efficiency of their coal plants, help them develop the technology. As the relationship has developed, they're now very much more of a partner. So when we work with the National Energy Administration, when we work with NDRC, we consider them an equal partner, and they actually work with us as much as we work with them, and it's jointly funded, and we find it very beneficial in the U.S. as well as helping China. So moving forward to 2009, and even in 2008, under Secretary Paulson's 10-year framework, we started looking more at the climate issues. And so how do you make coal not only more efficient, but how do you do clean coal? How do you capture carbon from a coal plant and sequester it or use it? We've been very active in this area under our flagship partnership called the Clean Energy Research Center. We have a very active coal program. It's joint R&D, jointly funded by the U.S. government and not only MOST, but NEA. And it's really looking at carbon capture and utilization options. And we've made actually some very good progress in this area. Particularly Duke and their partners, Huaneng, have been looking at the carbon capture plant in Shanghai and looking at the efficiencies and whether or not it can be replicated in the U.S. So that's kind of a brief overview of what we're doing on coal. But I really want to focus the talk more on some of the reasons why we work with China. So I get a lot of questions. You know, you read the newspaper, China and the U.S. don't get along in this area and they don't get along in this area. And so I get, you know, why are we working with China? Why is it so important that DOE work with our counterparts in China? And I wanted to give basically five reasons. The first, and these are not in any particular order of priority, but the first is to manage global issues. If you're looking at climate change, if you're looking at nuclear proliferation, if you're looking at energy security, China and the U.S. play a huge role in global issues. And if we're working together, we can solve these issues. If we're working at opposite ends, we're not going to be able to do that. The second reason is to promote commercial interests in China and conversely promote Chinese interest in the U.S. We both have a role to play in each other's markets, whether it's Chinese investment in our energy sector or U.S. investment in the Chinese energy sector. We have comparative advantages, whether it's capital, technology, where we are in development, how fast we're building out. We actually have a mutual benefit in investing in each other's infrastructure. We also want to take advantage of the Chinese ramping up their energy sector. And what I mean by that is if you're deploying new technologies, you first have to demonstrate them. The U.S. sector is growing much slower than the Chinese sector. If you really want to get new technologies out there, if you want to demonstrate that they work, if you want to deploy them quickly, working with the Chinese in their energy sector helps you do that. So whether it's a Chinese company or a U.S. company with an innovative idea, using the Chinese ramp up in their energy sector is very useful in deploying new technologies. Clean energy technologies are critical for climate change. Most of these energy technologies are going to be in place 30 to 40 years. Doing this now in China is very important. Promote knowledge and technical innovations that benefit both the U.S. and China through collaborative research. I mentioned our flagship program with China, the Clean Energy Research Center. We see this as a way to leverage not only scientists in both countries, but also the money in both countries to solve the problems we both face. It doesn't do us any good to have scientists over in the U.S. and scientists over in China who are not talking to each other, who are using the same amount of money and coming up with the same solutions. If we combine the money, if we combine the scientists, we can get further faster. And lastly, keep the channels of open communication on energy issues. The relationship building that comes from working on these technical issues builds a relationship so when we do have a big issue, we have the communication channels to talk about it. When Fukushima happened in Japan and China wanted to review their nuclear power plants, they asked DOE to help them. They know we have the capability to do the simulations and the modeling. Vice versa, when there's an oil shock and China wants to talk to the U.S. about how to mitigate that, they have an open communication channel to us. It's very beneficial for both countries to have this relationship, and based on trust and based on just working together on a day-to-day basis. So those are all very good reasons for us to do this. So what are the barriers to doing this? If you've read the newspapers, you've read about the trade cases, you've read about the IP issues, DOE does receive a lot of pressure because of these cases, particularly when they're about solar or when they're about wind turbines. So basically our biggest barriers to working with China are not kind of the typical, you know, which ministry does what, who has responsibility, but actually the political pressure from outside. Whether it's market access or IP issues or the cyber issues, we get pressure from the interagency as well as the public when we're working with China. Now, never mind, our programs do not actually get directly involved in renewables and we don't get directly involved in the cyber. That pressure still exists. So what DOE has tried to do to help mitigate some of that is in our major programs, we have worked with our partners, and we have put in place public-private partnerships in almost all of our big initiatives. So with the private sector involved, we can help discuss market access issues. And when I say private sector, I'm not talking just about the U.S. private sector. Chinese companies have the same interests as some of the U.S. companies. They want to see their IP protected. They want to see market access for their companies in the U.S. So when we bring together the private sector of both countries into these programs, we have a way to talk about market access issues. We have a way to plan around some of the tricky potential trade-related issues. With the CERC, we were able to even negotiate an IP agreement that worked for our private sector companies. Again, I want to emphasize the Chinese companies were asking for this IP agreement as strongly as the U.S. companies. So building these relationships, being able to talk about these political pressure from the outside, we were able to have a really solid foundation for our cooperation. So I'll leave it at that because I know I only have a few minutes, but I'm happy to take questions at the end, either about sort of the broader political issues or about coal-specific issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Cathy. And I met her a day before yesterday in the DOE, so we already discussed something how to encourage the future cooperation. So I fully agree with a lot of things you already said. Why the cooperation between U.S. and China on the energy is so significant for China, or even for both of us, because I think that we can look at that in the two points of view. One is to avoid conflict, because for a long time the people have a lot of concern about any supply, energy security, energy market balance, and so on. And when China came into the market, becomes an importer, and we do have some concern from other countries, including maybe U.S. But the fact is that China is not really destroying the markets. China contributes to the markets, and every year China contributes more than $250 billion for the oil and petrol and the natural gas sectors in the world. So it helps all the world becomes more, you know, keep a lot of places becomes more stable. And I think the capital of the energy capital get a lot from China as well. So it's not really destroy the system, it's improve the system. So the second is, I think the cooperation will means to explore a new future, because we face the same challenge. Not only for the energy supply themselves, but also mainly the climate change challenge. So if we collaborate each other, and we can help both sides and even for the world to solve the problem more smoothly. And if we are not involved, and if we cannot cooperate actively, that is the response to the climate change will be slower down. So that's important. And of course, I fully agree with the ambassador said, you know, we may have somewhere we do have some kinds of conflict, or but we need to explore more place, then we do have much win-win potential. That is important. So the energy fields and climate fields is the challenge face of both. So we can make it as a very important fields to develop the cooperation and the win-win solution. So, you know, it's a fact that from this morning, everyone knows that we are top two energy consumers. We, both of us, added, we consumed over 40% of the total energy of the world as two countries. And we are top two greenhouse gas emitters. And maybe the share is similar with that the energy shares. You know, we have a very great the impact on the world energy markets, technology, and the climate change of the world. So in most of the cases, so that's just an increased importance and the significance of our cooperation in the energy fields. So I think politically and all the Chinese industrial sectors, we really attach importance for the energy cooperation with the U.S. And I believe U.S. Is the same position, as Cassie already mentioned. We are trying to promote that. We have a lot of progress. And some people calculate that they say even more than 200 different kinds of agreements or memo are signed between the two countries by different government agencies and official arrangement. And there are some, yes, very important, like the U.S.-China framework for the 10-year cooperation on energy and environment. And we have an eco partnership agreement. And we already developed a city-to-city company between companies and universities cooperation on like a clean power generation, electric car, wind power, clean coal, shale gas, and CCS, and other environmental related with energy issues for cooperation. And a lot of projects happened. Recently, the clean energy programs, including more efforts on the buildings and the renewables, play a very important role as well. It becomes real things happen for the cooperation besides of a lot of agreements. These activities promoted the cooperation on technology development and real business. So there's achievements. But if we look at the real thing happening in the energy sectors, I think the further efforts necessary, because although there are many activities, but the big results is rather limited. Why? China now invested about $6 trillion per year as a capital investment. And more than $300 billion in the energy sectors. But our corporation I think impact only very few of that, although achievement there, but how to really leverage the activities on the energy sectors, and if you including the energy utilization sectors, that our activities are quite not enough. And the second is the bigness is very limited. You know, we have a lot of agreements, some kinds of activities, some cooperation, but the big business, the big cooperative enterprises activities is very few. And once we had something like that for Sinox purchase some company assets, then some people will say, oh, it's dangerous, it's not, we have to check that. So let's put it not as a, you know, willingness, but we have to really, like Ambassador say, that we need real bigness, right? Big business is important for the future. We have to overcome some obstacles for real investment. The study or cooperative research has not yet got very influential technology as output. Of course, it needs time. But on the other hand, I think the both sides input is not enough. It's not becomes the mainstream. It becomes some side event of the mainstream. But of course, it's we can improve that. And the cooperative projects as a total has a too small scale compared with the huge capital investment on these sectors. And in general, the political process is very long and it takes a couple of years and even several years but before real things started. So we have to shorten that process. And both sides have different kinds of policy implementing mechanisms in two countries. For example, in China, in general, the policy of government is really related with the company's investments is very closely be matched. But we don't know what happens because sometimes American government has said they have no influence on the company, more or less. Or it's very difficult to initiate the government money to really do things with China. So sometimes we need to find a way how to overcome this concept. To some extent, it makes the Chinese side always be, you know, not understanding because we have so many agreements. Finally, the difficulties to be implemented somewhere. So it becomes next time if we collect a company to work with us, the company say, okay, we already talked so long. What will happen? So they are not so positive response. That's our challenge, the Chinese government always faced sometime. So we need the agreement between us becomes more effective. So we have to find a way how to overcome this kind of obstacles. And of course, the trust wake, not in the energy fields, but more or less be influenced by other sides. For example, how the science technology cooperation and the collaboration can be pursued. It's not an energy problem. It's more or less there are more obstacle, I think, in this side, in your side, right? So you have a lot of limits. This kind of things cannot do with China. That kind of thing China can be involved. That's very limited. A lot of new technology development and cooperative exploration. So, and of course, Kaiser already mentioned that some kinds of negative rumor as a cyber security complaint. But as I know, you know, there no any Chinese any company say they have a cyber arm to do anything like that. So I think is, you know, if you really want the technology detail, how the cyber, if there were cyber arm, they know the technology. They know what kinds of so-called secrets can be stored. So it's very, very, you know, to some extent, if you are technical people, you will not understand why it happened. So this is something we have to overcome. And I think that we have to look at the future. We need to enhance responsibilities for the world future, especially in the low carbon. Currently, I think the challenge is not how to keep the balance. It's how to make the energy technology and the energy system of our two countries and even to have the whole world to become the low carbon system in the future. So we need to take the lead in this area by the two countries. And of course, we will cooperate with others, not only between us. And we will have to promote real bigness and a stronger political willingness to work on this area. So we need more comprehensive and consistent policy to promote cooperation and cooperation in any field. That's, you know, sometimes it's the, as a DOE's friend said, it's not so, under their control. So I think we have to find a better environment to, as a comprehensive and harmonious the policy package in both sides. Then I would like to say something coal. Coal is both of the challenge and uncertainty. Because although we are talking about how to cooperate in the coal, but practically, I am personally puzzled how to really promote the so-called cooperation on coal. Because if you want to use more coal or you want to use less coal, that's a direction different. So we are top two coal consumers. China consumes about 3.6 billion tons of coal, and the U.S. in general is 1 billion. And now it's a little bit less. In my understanding, China's coal is going to come to the ceiling, will be kept for the coal consumption in the future, near future, and very soon, in my understanding. It's not 10, 20 years after. It could come into the 3-5 years. The cap will be established. And China's coal is already declined. So in this case, how can we cannot say, okay, because the Chinese units have the spare coal, you can export to China. But if China declines the demand, what has happened? So we have to look at the different kinds of forecasting, and especially the local, the pollution control will be the first priority in China. It will limit the coal consumption in the future very soon. And the Chinese government, based on the situation, already decided to declare the so-called total amount control of the energy consumption by 2015. They already limit the total amount of primary energy, and I think the coal will face the first challenge to increase. So carbon emission will be the biggest challenge for coal future. So that means clean coal technology, if you don't care the carbon, it would not be clean. If you develop such kinds of so-called clean coal technology, you will face bigger challenge in the future. So we have to combine the low carbon coal technology if we really say it's clean coal technology. But in the temporarily, in the short term, to improve the efficiency, to clean the emission of the traditional pollutants still is important. But if you look at 20 years after, then the technology could be a very short lifetime. So that's the real challenge. So current coal business and trace or is our focus point, or we focus on longer term low carbon coal technology or replacement. I think that we need to do better choice from both sides. I think this needs more study and exchange. So we cannot lock in the current so technology to make it more detailed. This is a challenge for us. So, but anyway, coal still play important role in for long. By 2050, in the most optimized or optimistic forecast for the low carbon mix of China, yes, China still may use 1 or 2 billion tons of coal by that time, but it's already half of current amount. And many models suggest CCS has to be used in the near future. So we have to solve what means cleaner utilization technology and mesh use for the at least 30 years, 20 years, or even longer. And we have to really look at CCS, and it's not only technology, how the system will work, where you put it, right? How the pipeline or everything will be set up. It's not 100 million tons. It's several billion tons of carbon dioxide. It's a big system. It's not a small text. So it's a big challenge. For two cementants, the imports right now for the coal is a supplementary of the coal supply of China, but I don't think it's for longer, because we may have the surplus of the so-called production supply in the near future. So the competition will be very serious. And I hope that the lower coal price will not lead to more carbon emission. That's my concern. Potential for technology cooperation or collaboration is very wide. You will see the list there. The coal emission control technology, advanced coal clean combustion technology, advanced coal-fired power generation technology, and clean coal transform technology. It's already happened somewhere. Electricity transmission, super high voltage transmission, or smart grids that fit to the distributed and renewable-based and combined with how the big coal-fired power plant can be operated in that case. We are facing the problem in China. And so I think the both countries, I cannot take the time to say where the China is in advance, where is the United States have better technology right now. But my suggestion is the technology is not enough. We have to work harder on this area. And some related technology as well, for example, coal massing and coal gas emission control and utilization, because there's a big emission of the greenhouse gas as well. Thank you very much. Maybe I should pass my time.
Thank you, Dr. Zhou. And I think with this, we have heard the voice from both governments, because both of them can represent actually quite well the thinking of the governments. And I think one common phenomenon we can find out is both are calling for the real business engagement and action from the private sector. So I think now we are very lucky to have the comments from the private sector. Michael, thank you.
Okay, thank you. The good news is I do not disagree with any of the comments from the previous two speakers. They did a good job at framing the issues, and the opportunity is a very high level. I can talk more about the practicalities of trying to collaborate in China. We went to China in 2009 with some clear goals. The first one was technology. Very much in line with what Casey said, we wanted to try and bring clean energy technology to the US with lower R&D costs. We also wanted to take advantage of scaling technology, as mentioned by Casey. We also wanted to leverage resources. We actually wanted access to Chinese capital markets. Now, some people might say we already borrow enough money from China, but I couldn't possibly comment on that. Also, we wanted to look at new business opportunities. We want to advance economic development in the U.S. through Chinese investment. Before we went to China, we'd some trepidation about things. And Casey, again, framed it very well. You know, we were the top concerned by not just coal and really across all industries of the IP issue, but also then just the lack of trust on both sides, and that's just from not knowing each other and having different cultures. And also then knowledge poaching, which is really the IP issue. But also there's a lack of a tested collaboration process. We're not really used to this. We're getting better at it. But if you think about, you know, the practicality of trying to do it, what we came across was more to do with things like bureaucracy and even the business culture as called Guanxi. I hope I pronounced that correctly. I'm starting to know what Guanxi is. We actually have someone in a Beijing office that helps us with our relationship building, and she's Chinese, so she knows what Guanxi is. Communication, language itself. You can imagine the challenges, and I'm just learning those. When I go to China, I speak with a Northern Ireland accent, so that adds further difficulty. And just cultural differences. And then organizational structure. The U.S. organizations now are very lean and not very hierarchical, so we kind of delegate a lot. In China, it's not quite like that, so communication has slowed down, and it maybe impedes action plans getting done between the two organizations. And then just technology. At the moment, I say one of our goals was to bring technology over, but I don't know if the U.S. market is quite ready for Chinese technology in many aspects. But I could mention a couple of real roadblocks we ran into, which probably add some value. There are multiple levels of U.S. regulatory bodies overseeing foreign investment into the U.S. energy market, and they look at the implications across the whole energy value chain, but also the investment aspects themselves. So we actually wanted to do a joint venture and build a wind farm in the U.S. and have a Chinese partner, and that was turned down. So that was a roadblock. Also, what we find is just if you work one-on-one in China, we actually, as a utility company, have very little to offer, and we have technology. We actually want technology. So it's kind of hard to go to China and try and get technology if you don't have anything to offer. Especially in the coal arena, but in the nuclear arena, it's quite different. We've had a great success, and it's pretty worth mentioning because it really helps you understand how you might be able to work successfully with coal also. But in China, they're building a lot of new nuclear plants, and we would like to do that in the U.S., but we're much slower in the process, and we want to build AP1000 units, so China's building those, so we can go over and an exchange, and that's the key, the exchange of, you know, Chinese organizations want something from us that we can give them and vice versa. So we're giving them training and experience of operation of, you know, we've in the US there's 104 nuclear plants, in China there's 26. So they're very receptive to working with us. And we're going to get to see the startup of these units in China. So that's probably a good example of how we might work together. But the opportunities are great, I think. I can talk firsthand about our experiences with the U.S.-China Clean Energy Research Center. It's been mentioned several times that we're involved. We certainly have a need to solve some very formidable problems, and you captured them very well, the technologies that we need to solve. We're not there yet. We really have many different problems. Really, you know, to cover it well, it's really the efficient extraction of energy and conversion to electricity. And we want to minimize the emissions and CO2. We need a portfolio of capture, utilization, storage options. We need actually to also learn how to have the long-term operations of our existing coal plants. Both China and the US have very similar policies of developing new coal and retiring old ineffective units or inefficient. But we really need to think about how we can keep those going. Now that we've invested in scrubbers and SCRs, it seems to make sense to keep those units, which you saw the graph, the capacity additions in the US were mainly in the 70s and the 80s. Those plants were designed for no more than 30 years. But now we've invested a lot of money in those. We need to keep those plants running and then also tee those up for even technology that could capture carbon. And then the water issue is really coming at us fast, the water energy nexus, if we refer to it. And really today, you know, our company is certainly very concerned, not just about wastewater treatment itself, but also using less water in the future. We see that being added to that. You saw many charts about all these emissions, I mean, all these regulations coming. Well, we feel that that's just going to be added to in the future, and it's not going to be less, and there's going to be pressure to reduce water. So, you know, just to leave you with one key aspect to what we find that worked well about CERC was that although it took 12 months to get things rolling, and that was to do with the IP protection, but that really, I think, produced a new way of thinking, produced a kind of a good approach for maybe collaboration in the future. That's the number one issue in our industry, across every industry. So I think now we can go past that. And once you get past that, it's a matter of having really a clear shared vision. And if you have that and you have the partners all working towards a common goal that they really want, and we have a common goal, it was up on the chart there, the common goals is clean energy. The common goal should also be not to get rid of coal, but to gradually transition into other forms. We want to maintain a balanced portfolio of options. We cannot today, even in my lifetime, think that, you know, when I die that there will be no coal. I don't think so, but there could be. But coal should be, you know, it's a balanced portfolio. You need to maintain affordable electricity for everybody. So to do that, you're going to have gas, nuclear, coal, you're going to have renewables. And, of course, I think you can definitely scale back. But you should not give up on coal yet. I mean, you could maybe find ways of using coal, gasifying it, and having clean coal. So really, I say the CERC effort is a good start, and they have clear goals. There was also a comprehensive governance structure and also very detailed plans that were managed well. So it's a promising indication that China and the U.S. can move forward in collaboration. But I say there's a lot more work to be done. So thank you.
Thank you, Michael. I think you also what you just talked also reflect a lot of barriers we mentioned in the previous discussion. I think with that, we also would like to welcome the voice from the academia. Stuna.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm from Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and from China Energy Group. So yesterday, when I was having dinner with Dr. Zhou Dadi, he mentioned that maybe he should be the one who's speaking. I should be the one who's speaking. He should be commenting. I couldn't agree more. So before I came to this conference, I thought I probably don't have much to offer because our group focused on energy demand, energy efficiency, not much on energy supply or coal issues. Heard many of our speakers and commentator expert and to talk about coal supply issues and some of the opportunities at the same time, the challenges in collaborating on coal supply. And we heard possible conflicting energy security or trade dispute, and or in terms of technology, we all know a lot of the new Chinese coal plant, they're a lot more efficient than U.S. Coal plant in the U.S. But I think now maybe it's time to change the gear a little bit and to talk about the potential on collaborating in reducing the coal demand. I think there's a great potential and a lot of opportunities in the demand, on the demand side, for U.S. and China work together and to possibly maybe reduce the coal consumption by half. And in that year, I can give many examples and in the past and how we successfully collaborated. And then I can talk a little bit and some of the new innovative framework we can use for future collaboration. So because I started talking about energy demand, and I need to mention that China's coal consumption, as many experts also talked about, probably will peak and maybe before 2020. And China's coal mostly used the industry sector, which is very unique and special in comparison to many other developed countries. And so a lot of focus and has been in industry sector, how to reduce and the demand there and improve the efficiency. However, also half of the coal used in industry, they're used for coking and for feedstock, and for which we have very limited option to reduce. And going forward, we do see the potential and could come from building sector and the transportation sector. And because energy demand in those sectors will continue to grow and they use a lot of electricity, and electricity mostly generated from coal. So if you can reduce the demand in those sectors, and actually we have a lot of potential to reduce overall coal consumption and energy consumption. So in the last 20 to 30 years, we see a lot of successful collaborations. Our group is one of the examples. the existence of our group and the sustainability of our group provided a sort of collaborative model. So our group has been around for 25 years. We have our 25-year anniversary this year. And I want to mention Dr. Zhou Dadi actually is one of the people who actually helped initiate our group together with our group leader, Dr. Mark Levine, and back in 1988. And when DOE delegation visited China and asked whether it would be opportunity for collaboration, Chinese officials and experts, including Dr. Zhou Dadi, mentioned energy efficiency. Energy efficiency is exactly the area U.S. has a lot of experiences and knowledge to offer, and China was in need and for capacity building. So that was original purpose for establishing our group. And Dr. Yang Fuqiang, many of you already heard, and his talk this morning was also one of our group members for many years. And so for the many years we worked in building sector, appliance efficiency, and industry sector, and also in policy analysis modeling together with our Chinese counterpart. And the collaboration model include bringing the Chinese scholars to our lab to provide training in the use of the tools or methodologies used here to support policies and in the U.S. For example, the Energy Star initiated and implemented by U.S. EPA, and also standard, a lot of the standard development for appliances basically managed by Department of Energy. And also in the building code, in terms of developing a more efficient building code for China, we introduced the tool we developed here in DOE 2.2, and which is also a DOE tool. We introduced that tool for our Chinese collaborators and they use it to develop their building codes. And we're just one of the examples of the collaboration between the researchers, academias, and others, including WRI. I see many colleagues here, and NRDC, and together with a lot of other organizations, and they all have many projects in China and have a lot of collaboration. So I do not see barriers or concerns or issues in terms of collaboration between the two countries and among the academias or research institutions. So, but I do want to mention we see some a little bit of barrier or concerns when it comes to the collaboration between the two governments. Dr. Zhou Dadi just mentioned that there are hundreds of MOUs signed and the new initiatives launched and all these new programs, but the very limited impact and the very limited effect. And that's because of the many reasons both Casey and Dr. Zhou also mentioned. And however, I do want to offer and introduce this very new pioneering platform, which Casey and Michael also mentioned. It's the U.S.-China Clean Energy Center, and which has three consortium. One is coal, one's a vehicle, another is building energy efficiency, which I am leading. And so I want to introduce why this is a pioneering and could be potential sustainable platform for the future collaboration between the two countries. So what's new about this CERC is first, the two governments provide very strong support and committed and funding. And each country committed $5 million for each CERC. So altogether, that's $15 million for three centers. But half of the funding from the government and half on the U.S. side, that's from Department of Energy. On the China side, it's from MOST, Ministry of Science and Technology. And also at the same time, the other half is matched by our industry partners. I think Duke Energy is one of the industrial partners on the coal center. And in our building center, we have six companies who are on our board, and they are contributing the equivalent amount of funding into our research and development. So it started with $2.5 million 2 years ago. In the last 2 years, they have increased the contribution to $4 million a year, and which almost doubled the initial pledge. So we see that increasing interest from our industry partners. That's probably because they see benefit and for them to be a part of the program. And also, our researchers are collaborating, many of them for the first time in building sector. We're working on six areas, and the researchers in the U.S. and working very closely with our Chinese researchers, and they have biweekly video conferences, phone calls, they have visits, and they started from scratch, didn't know each other because of this framework, a program brought them together, and then now working together, developing technologies and applying it, demonstrating in China, and eventually try to commercialize those technologies and then maybe use it for both U.S. and Chinese market. So we see the CERC platform provide a very good channel for the governments to talk to each other, establish very good relationship, and going forward. And we see that the businesses on both sides, on the U.S. side and Chinese side, and they are, because they are included in the program, they will be talking to each other and figuring out the business opportunities. So we see that happening. And then there's also this strong collaboration between the researchers. And so it's a win-win-win situation and for governments, industries, and academia. So we really hope this collaboration model and could be sustained and used for any other future collaboration in research development and in even policy analysis area going forward between the two countries. With that, I think we'll leave more time for questions and comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Zhunan. And I think before opening the floor to the audience, I will possibly take the privilege as the moderator to raise two questions very briefly to our two speakers. The first one would be to Casey. As you mentioned, a lot of the barriers that exist in between the business collaborations between U.S. and China. I was very curious about, for example, the size of the companies in the co-sectors. We all know that China has some of the largest, world largest co-companies in the world, whereas the U.S. counterparts may not be as big. So when they talk to each other, do you think the kind of like difference in their size and potentially their influence would become a good incentives for collaboration or actually a barrier?
So let me, I'll give two examples where the differences in the U.S. and China system can be an issue. So if a lot of the energy development in the U.S. is done by small to medium-sized companies, the coal mining sector, with shale gas particularly, you have very small, medium companies doing that. So when you when the two governments get together and they say, oh, yeah, we should be collaborating on these issues, this is great, when the U.S. government goes and talks to small and medium companies in the U.S., they're not really ready to go and talk to China, you know. frankly, they're a small company. They want to work in the U.S. They have a big market. They may have plans to grow in the U.S., but most of them are not thinking internationally. And if they're thinking internationally, they're thinking of something that's maybe a little bit easier in their minds, which would be, you know, Europe or somewhere where they, you know, they don't need a lot of cultural background in order to survive. So there's a psychological barrier, I think, to many small to medium companies going into China. You know, a much larger company like GE, they go into China, they have a lot of staff resources, they have people who speak Chinese, they have people who are Chinese nationals to help them navigate. They can hire consultants to figure out the bureaucracy. Small companies just don't have the resources to do that. So I think that's an issue. I'll also bring up another slightly different issue just from the U.S. Perspective is I worked on methane to markets at EPA for several years. And one of the things I saw there and my own observation is when you go to a very large coal mine in China, they're very focused, obviously, on mining coal. So when you go and you want to talk to them about developing gas from coal mines through the gas coming in through the seams, they are really not that interested. You know, their performance and their is based on how much coal they mine. In the U.S., it's a slightly different model. You have very small companies, and again, they don't want to deal with natural gas. They're coal miners. They're going to mine coal. But you have gas companies, small gas companies, who are willing to develop for mutually beneficial terms. We don't see that model in China. Again, it's been a while since I've worked on these kind of issues, so that may have changed slightly. But the structure in the U.S. lends itself a little bit more to co-developing gas and coal than in these large state-owned enterprises. So I think, you know, the regulatory structure is also affected by the size of the mining. And so I think you get different outcomes. Now, that's not to say China and the U.S. shouldn't compare notes and talk about what's good, what's working, what's not working, what the environmental issues are. But you have to, when you structure those discussions, you have to be aware of the dynamics so that, you know, you're not kind of talking at cross purposes in these discussions.
Thank you very much. I think the second question then is to Dr. Zhou Dadi and also to our other colleagues here. When we talk about the coal exports from U.S. to China, we were actually having very good intentions that this may able to help China to replacing some of the dirty domestic coal minings and improving their records of the emissions. But how on earth we can actually make sure that this is only replacing the domestic coal mining, not actually pushing out and squeeze the market for the clean energy that developing in China?
I think I have mentioned that a little bit, but you know, China now import about near 300 million tons in the last year for the coal importing. It becomes really a market for the Chinese coal market. But what happened is because of two issues. Yes, because at the last decades, the coal increases so quickly, so transportation facility is always behind. So sometimes the transportation facility is not enough, and the cost becomes high. So that makes the in the southeast parts the coal price is 20 even 25% more than that in the north part. So the international coal becomes competitive. So and it helped to smooth some kinds of shortage of the transportation and the supply. But yes, the background is the coal increase rate is very high. So each year we need additional 200 million tons of the additional coal. So it happened very easily. And from the policy point of view, that China already have a policy not declared, but it becomes a consensus that we were encouraged to import some kinds of energy resources to help to you know, to release the pressure on the domestic production of the resources. So it matched with the demand. But if the demand changed, I think the situation, especially for the competitive of the foreign coal, will be changed. It really depends if in the future the import coal price can be continuously lower than the domestic supply, if the domestic supply capacity is in surplus. So that is a big risk so for these issues. But if the competition for the price becomes really serious, then the international coal price will went down, will go down. Then it could be a bad news for the renewables, more or less. Thank you.
And Dr. Chen, do you have anything to add on that?
No.
Okay. With that, we will open the floor to the audience. And I think the same principle that Kevin stated in the morning still applied. So please wait for your microphone and introduce yourself first. And ideally, please just ask one concrete question rather than general ones. And this gentleman.
Okay, actually, I have introduced myself this morning. I'm Jin
Song. You got more time than we do.
Yeah, I have a question to Dr. Zhou Dadi. You are a very popular energy expert in China. You know DOE well, of course. You know NEA and NDRC better. So my question is that what could we learn from United administration and what we can share with our United American friends on energy issues, especially on coal issues. Thank you very much.
I need to consider another one night to answer your questions. I think the system of both sides is not really the same. In China, the Energy Bureau, to some extent, is in charge of to handle the developments and operation to some extent of the energy sectors, more or less, to approve all the projects, to keep the market balance, and to handle the investment, and not only regulatory issues. So it's, the job is not the same. I think in this case, China is learning how to develop the so-called socialist market system. We still have a lot of things to learn how the market operated in different situations. Yes, cannot be simply copied. But at least I think the Chinese Energy Bureau weighs only about 150 people. And the DOE has 150 people. So it's quite different. So as Energy Information Agency, right? Under the DOE, you have the same size, even more than the total China's Energy Bureau administration. So the information collection and the preparation and it's quite good. I learned that from the website. I really appreciate that. But the Chinese Bureau want to do that, but they have only two people to take care of that. That's very difficult. So that's something you have to think about. How the government to be organized. It's not as only energy sector issues. It's totally what's the government function in different kinds of markets with different entities, players in the market. So it's a big challenge and a big questions. So I think we will learn still. Thank you.
I think this round we will take a few questions altogether. And the gentleman in the middle.
Zhongxiang, Fudan University, China. I have one small question to Kenzie, one small question to Director General Zhou. Suggestion is, I'm very impressed by Director General Zhou said there were 200 agreements between the two countries. But on the other hand, I'm not that surprised that they don't achieve much if you only look at the directly the result. Mm-hmm. So I would say that probably it's better to really look at this kind of agreement, what the result achieved directly and what is indirectly by improved know-how also. And also look at, is a kind of leverage to find opportunities. Because you said you work in the EPA. I remember a few years ago there was Manxing, coal mine in the Datong in Shanxi, and they finally found that opportunities. Then was the U.S. put some money, but mostly from ADB. Finally, they achieved great, so that's the thing I said. Maybe, they have the group here, Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory China Group. They're very good on this bottom line analysis. Maybe you use the American money to do this kind of policy analysis to see what kind of thing can improve and so on. Suggestion. My question to the Dr. Zhou is, a few years ago, I added a special issue of Journal of Policy Modeling. I get one contribution from MIT, Jacoby, Daniel Elman Group, to look at the rule of coal in the U.S. Basically, that study says that, given a certain price of coal, a certain price of carbon, and there's no worry about the coal, U.S. still can use the coal for 100 years and still can meet the Kyoto and all this kind of whatever climate agreement. But my point is, you know, for China, anyhow, the coal probably still used for quite a while and given the national endowment. So my point is, did you and your institution or maybe China have did some study, is there any kind of capacity in terms of storage and what kind of price, which is, you know, that China don't have to worry about the used coal as far as the CCS technology become commercialized?
Okay, and we take another questions here. Yes.
Dan Mara, George Washington University. Everybody agrees that the development of CCS is critically important.
Mm-hmm.
And you could imagine two, in simple terms, pathways to get to commercial scale CCS. One is public financed RD&D, and the other would be private companies, a consortium of private companies, developing the technology, patenting it, and selling it. Which pathway do you think is most likely?
Okay, thank you. And the last question, I think either is an... Okay, so the third one.
Hi, my name is Erica with the Center for Clean Air Policy, and my question is for Dr. Joe Dadi and Dr. Dalhotel. I'm just wondering, as China ramps up their cap and trade pilots, do you anticipate or are there existing discussions in, you know, if not national, but regional exchanges between the two countries in carbon trade?
Okay, thank you. So now... And we have the answers from our speakers.
Do you want me to go first?
Okay.
So on the MOUs, yeah, the U.S. government realized there's a proliferation of pieces of paper, frankly, that don't have a lot of commitment. And there's a variety of reasons for that. Part of that is... DOE is a very large organization. We have a lab structure of roughly 18, 19 labs under us. They all do their own MOUs with China. In addition to that, DOE actually has six major counterparts as well as several other institutes that we work with. And so when you work on something like energy efficiency in buildings, we end up going to each ministry separately and doing an MOU. Now, not all of that paper is, you know, only worth the paper it's written on. There are specific initiatives that either are renewed or get, you know, funded year after year. And so we try and actually graduate out as many of the MOUs as we can. We see, in some ways, I think early on, there was a lot of trial and error. We did an MOU, we started work. If things didn't quite work out the way we wanted, we backed off of that and tried something different. I think we're now at a point where we really know what issues we can work on and where we should be. And I think our Chinese counterparts would agree with that. And so we're trying to focus on the few key initiatives. And for us, it's the 10-year framework and the Clean Energy Research Center in particular. There's a couple of other industry forums that we find them very useful, like the Oil and Gas Industry Forum, the Renewable Energy Industry Forum. But other, you know, and there's a lot of nuclear, and I won't even go into all the nuclear non-proliferation stuff. But I think we are trying to focus our efforts on key MOUs and basically cut ties and move on from MOUs that aren't producing results. I would love to do a study and do a very scientific look at it. With interagency politics on both sides, it's much harder to do that. Do you want me to go ahead and answer or respond?
Up to you, which questions you want to answer.
I can also, on the private and public, I'll give sort of the U.S. answer to that. On CCS, we think it has to be both. Demonstration projects of carbon capture, utilization, and storage are, you know, in the billions of dollars. So DOE domestically is providing grant money from between $300 million to $500 million to about six projects in the U.S. that's demonstrating carbon capture and utilization. We're using it actually for enhanced oil recovery in Texas in particular. There's some other across the U.S. We are actually working with Chinese oil companies to participate in those projects in some cases. They would provide some of the contracting and for actually the generation of the electricity. So there, you know, there is a lot of ways that we're combining the two funding resources to do this. The CERC is also another example where we have the U.S. government, the Chinese government, and Chinese and U.S. private sector companies doing joint research. I think if you really want to accelerate this technology and get it the cost down to where it's actually, you know, usable by the companies, you're going to have to put as much as you can resource-wise towards these problems. And then on the regional exchanges, I think some of the regions in the U.S., Northeast and California come to mind, are looking at doing some cooperation with China. I don't actually know where those discussions are. So DOE, frankly, we're more of an R&D organization, and we have very few regulatory responsibilities. Cap and trade is not really in our bailiwick. So we do try and provide technical assistance to EPA and the regions in terms of technology suggestions, help through our labs, that kind of thing. But we haven't really been involved in the cap and trade discussions.
Thank you. Dr. Zhou, do you?
Because of time, I think that for Dr. Zhang's, Professor Zhang's question is if there is such kinds of carbon price or carbon tax to make the coal be used, but be limited as well. So I don't think it's true, because even for the U.S., there's not only price issues, there's the EPA's standards. That's each of the kilowatt hours electricity can emit only 350 grams of the carbon. That means only the gas combined cycle can meet that standard. Coal isn't, we have no such a technology. So it's this kinds of standards really kick out the coal into new built power plants. So it's standards issues. It's not the cost. But of course, in the model, the cost will be very efficient. But in the practice, I think the price or the tax could be one of the measures. But if you think about if you can continue to raise the tax, it will face a very difficult political pose, because you cannot use it as once. Then later on, all the things fixed. Based on that's a tax, then the consumer resumed. So then you have to raise the tax again. So it's a continuous strike with the political process. So we need both of the price incentives, tax, or something like that, and the standards, and the regulations, and the thresholds for the license, something like that. Second is the carbon trade. It's from the IPCC point of view, carbon trade at the beginning is to try to help to achieve the so-called least cost measures conclusion for some kinds of targets. If you want to cut down the emission, you need a cap system first to be established to allocate the quota, but the quota cannot be really fairly precisely to be allocated for each of the users. So you give them the room for trade if their cost is higher than others. But practically, the trade cost could be very high, and how to check it, how to continuously to check it, it's a challenge. So I think it's some kinds of mechanism try, but up to now it's not really a big solution. Yes, it could be theoretically gives the people like a soft curtain if they fall undone. Thank you.
Michael?
And I will try. And a lot of people with a lot of expectation for the trade system. But it helped to promote the quota system be accepted first. So that's
Thank
the
you.
Situation.
Anything to add from the discussion?
Well, just one thing. I think the carbon capture utilization storage issue is just really further emphasis of today. Problems are extremely complicated, and they need partnerships and collaboration to solve. And it's not just thinking of it in one dimension. It's large companies, small companies, it's government organizations, non-government organizations, and now even and academia, but even now extending that across the boundaries of countries. So I think that's just a good example.
So I want to reemphasize again the demand reduction for coal, particularly. And it's undeniable that we need to collaborate on the technology development, such as CCUS and together with other technologies. But when we look at China's energy demand and emission future all the way until 2050, and then look at the low carbon pathways and compare different policy measure technology that could be used, and look at the significance and impact on the demand reduction, what we found is that when we use CCS, it also adds some energy and CO2, because you're running and in the technology in this utilizing and compressing and transporting all these processes, you use a lot of energy. What we found is about the energy penalty is about 40%. You increase 40% of energy. With the new advanced technology, I heard it's still 25%. And so when we look at China's energy mix today, and electricity generation mostly still from coal. So if we use a coal generating electricity to run CCUS, and actually we're not reducing much CO2, we're adding more CO2. Only when the power sector is decarbonized more with more renewable and nuclear, and then with the additional energy use, and overall it can achieve some CO2 reduction. And then when we compare the contribution from CCS with demand reduction or energy efficiency measures, and they're not in the same magnitude. And there's a lot larger potential in improving efficiency in all the end-use sectors, and also large potential in reducing our demand, such as our human, our behavior, like whether we want to have more cooling or heating, more lighting, and such behavior change. And if we have policies to help people and to react into those energy reduction, and to have all the technologies, buildings, vehicles to be designed and built more efficiently, and we have a lot less dependence on the fossil fuel.
Thank you. I think we also have about 10 minutes for another round of questions. No? Seems we solved the issues very well.
And coffee break?
Yes.
Okay, so with that, please join me to thanks for the excellent panel discussion that we solved all the issues.